Sabrina George, New Comedy Radio. Still talking to Jill Edwards. yeah, so we're talking about new acts and sort of how they're getting going and stuff. And the common... not faults, mistakes. Common things. Some of them can turn into jokes within itself, but the common things that new acts do. And talking about honesty, and it's something, again, I find fascinating, is someone like Eddie Izzard, I don't know really much more about his life than at the end of an hour and a half or 2 hours true. With him.
Yeah.
But I do feel I know him.
But you know how he sees cats, and yeah, absolutely.
I feel like I could sit down and start a conversation with him about anything. So I find it this thing about honesty, that being honest, as you're saying, about the tragedies in your life, if you haven't got over it. And some people, I mean, I find that there's certain things I'd love to talk about, but people won't take from me.
No, not in that arena, in a different arena.
In a different
That's
arena.
Maybe a book.
I might find them funny.
Yeah.
I might have got over them, but audiences are just like, nah.
Yeah, there are certain things that audiences really find it really difficult to hear about.
And that, to me, goes with the persona.
Yeah.
If you've got a certain persona, I mean, the fabulous Johnny Vegas, for instance, I think him going on stage talking about having a happy life, which he seems to be having at the moment, it's not funny. But him talking about absolute abject humiliation, terrible
things.
It
fits, doesn't it?
You just go, I want more.
I think that's a really interesting point, that you don't know any more about Eddie Izzard's life, but you feel you know him. That's very interesting, because that's absolutely right. We don't need to know about your life, but we need to feel we know you. So your attitude towards bin liners, or I don't know,
that's got to be honestly held.
Yeah, and then we know something about you. You can tell a lot about people from the little things. It's the little details about people's lives that can tell you an awful lot about them.
Mm.
I love that. We don't need to know. We definitely don't need to know your tragedies on stage.
Because a lot of audience people, you know, the common refrain is, "Oh, that's so terrifying. You must be nervous." And I go, "Well, the first year, horrible." But that does not fear me. That is not what challenges my fear. What challenges my fear now is trying to say something that is honest and coming from myself and hoping the audience will accept it.
Mm.
And it doesn't even have to be anything particularly dramatic, but just like, have you noticed this about, I don't know, buying candles? I mean, one of my pet noirs is a lot of comics talk about all women go shopping endlessly for shoes.
Yes.
Now, I don't, so does that cease to make me a
woman?
Yeah,
no, that's a great idea, though, because you can tackle that in material, because people know that all comics talk about women doing that.
Mm.
That's when it becomes interesting, when you start turning the whole thing back on its head. When everyone's talking about women, all women do this, then one woman stands up and says, well, you know, does that mean I'm not a woman? Oh, my God. And that then the audience will like, because they love stuff where you're assuming they know something.
They're part of the game.
Yeah. I was just thinking, in terms of serious stuff, though, there was that great show, wasn't there, by Andre Vincent about the cancer thing. That was very clever. But I think maybe you have to have been going a long, long time, be very established, and maybe doing a show in Edinburgh, a whole one-hour show, to tackle any major big themes.
Well, that leads us on to the next thing. So once a comic's got their 5 minutes of tightly honed material without any padding,
yes,
they've found their persona, or maybe still in the process of finding, but they're getting
probably
close to it.
Yeah, they should have it by the time they've got 5 minutes, although it's going to take a little while to develop everything.
Yeah. Well, I certainly took much longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
I was a very long developer.
I think it takes a couple of years, actually, before... You've got your five minutes set. It's tightly honed. It works. You feel comfortable enough with your persona. Got some idea of performance skills and stuff. And then off you go out onto the circuit getting gigs, basically, as a new ad. But what will happen over the next couple of years... I run an advanced workshop, a weekly advanced workshop, that all my students tend to do after they've done the foundation course. And what I'll notice over the next couple of years, and it is pretty much always a couple of years, is that they'll be developing and changing and going in slightly different directions. And everything that they did at the beginning will slightly modify. Sometimes they'll write a whole new 5 minutes and it'll be different from the first one, but you can see where it's come from. Their persona then may change a bit. But by the end of that 2 years, they probably will have reached the point where they're actually pretty clear about what they're doing and what works for them as a comic. But I do notice that it is a massive development, because the only way they can develop once they've got that set is by gigging. Gigging experience is everything. It shows so much. And doing a gig and learning from whether the set worked or whether the set didn't work. You know, if it doesn't work and they die on their asses, which they will a lot to begin with.
It's part of the job.
Absolutely part of the job. They come back to me and they go, okay, I died at so-and-so. And I go, all right, fine. What happened? What do you think happened? Why? Was it this? Was it that? Was it the other? And I usually know them well enough to say something like, do you think you might have been speaking too quickly? And they'll probably come and go, oh, maybe. So often I'll know what it is that they've done because it's kind of obvious, but other times there'll be other students there and I'll go, okay, you were there, what did you notice happening? And the most extraordinary things will come up that'll explain why they've died, and then we go, okay, so we need to fix this, you need to fix that, gonna have to get you to speak slower, or you need to sort out a stronger opening or whatever. And as they fix all the things that make them die, gradually they stop dying so much. It's basically the process, that's how it works, I think.
And the more you succeed, the more you want to succeed. You build on that. Because I started off as a deadpan comic. I really thought that's what I was. And I really like deadpan comics. I've always liked them. And I thought that's what I was.
Yeah.
And I think I died for 11 months.
Deadpan is really hard to do as well.
Well, actually, I wasn't a deadpan comic. I was using deadpan-ness to hide behind, if you like.
Yeah.
And I can't say it was totally fear. There was an element of that. And then somebody just, basically, it was Francesca Martinez, she impersonated me one day after I died again. And she did such a brilliant job, and I went, my God, is that what I look like? And actually, what I thought was deadpan was sulky, angry, aggressive.
Yeah, which audiences hate aggressive.
And I didn't see that at all. Mm. I couldn't, because inside, I didn't feel like that at all.
Mm.
And I dropped it completely, and from then on, things started to build and build and build, and I started to realise that actually, I have a high energy in my voice, and I might not physically have much, you know, move around much, but certainly my energy, and I have a lot of change, and there's a lot of, like, winking at the audience and commenting on something through my facial expressions. I actually have a very big facial, pronounced face. You know, people can see my eyebrows moving.
Yeah,
they can see my eyes moving.
It's a great
and stuff.
Advantage, actually.
Yes. A huge advantage, and I had never used it. And once I started to realise that just that little sort of wink over something or little comment over something, the throwaway line, the whole thing started to change. So it took me a long time to get that. And it was thank God for Francesca impersonating me so brilliantly.
But that's the whole joy of the students. The students, and obviously Francesca being an ex-student as well, the students know you, students on your workshop know you really well.
Yeah.
And they'll also, one of the bookers said to me a while back, I can always tell when they're students from your course that are doing my club, because they tend to go and sit in a corner and give each other feedback.
Yeah, yeah.
They sit and go, okay, and they do feedback, and they do it the way that I teach them to do it in the class. I never actually said this is what you do after clubs or anything, but they obviously just adopted it, and it's just the sweetest visual image of two particular students sitting giving each other feedback really seriously after a gig. It's just really nice. I like that, the power of more than one. It's a tough job if you're trying to get off the circuit on your own.
Mm.
The more people you connect them to work with on a regular basis, the easier it's going to be.
Yeah, yeah. Well, for me, making that 180-degree change, it was completely opposite, meant that from then on I could rely much more on the audience to give me the feedback, because I feel that audiences are, in a way, almost more honest than somebody who likes you and is giving you feedback.
Mm.
They can give you technical tips, but an audience, it sounds like a really weird thing, but you're giving out your material, but at the same time you have to learn to listen.
Mm.
And that means listening for body language, that means listening for atmosphere, listening to the audience takes on a persona of its own. And if you're not connecting with that persona, what do I need to change or what do I need to emphasise to build on that? And
so
that, to me,
important.
Is why gigging is almost more important than doing the workshops. They're both important.
Oh,
but
they've got
bit
to be done
is
together.
So essential.
The gigging is absolutely essential. It's crucial that you gig. What I do with the advanced workshop is it supports people to gig. It exists in order to support people to gig. So I'm here in Brighton. I have a lot of contacts with all the local clubs here. And all my students all do tryout spots at all the local clubs, and it's as important. So once they've joined the advanced group, they have access to an awful lot of performing here, and it's absolutely essential they do it, because there's no point in doing the advanced workshop and not gigging. That's pointless.
Mm.
The point is to gig and then get the support of
bring it back
and then
take it apart and have a look at it and then
absolutely
go out there again. Yeah.
Oh yeah, we have a little gig report every week. And people get up and say, oh, this happened at this gig and da-da-da, and then everyone's learning from each other. And they do tend to do gigs together as well, just to kind of, so that when they bring it back, there's several of them there.
supporting each other.
Yeah.
Because I'm sort of thinking of the person who is out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, at the moment, Finland has a 3-year record of stand-up comedy. It's relatively recent. So most of the comics that are doing the Finnish circuit will only have, even the most established, have only been going for 3 years, which in London terms is babies.
Yeah. That's new acts.
And I find that really interesting, and particularly if they're starting out fairly fresh, they're really listening to almost a new act for advice and support and help.
Yeah.
And there are other countries where that's happening now, that's starting to emerge. Stand-up comedy is becoming more popular in various places where it's never... I know, absolutely brilliant.
Fantastic. But what will happen...
But how they do that without that support structure.
Well, it's quite possible that what will happen... I mean, the circuit in London started that way. You know, the comedy circuit in London started with... people, I mean, teaching stand-up comedy workshops and courses are still relatively new. I'm the only one, as far as I know, that runs one, an advanced workshop that goes on, and people can be part of for like several years. I think what will happen, which will be very exciting in each of these countries, is they will actually create their own version of the circuit. I mean, it'll be their comedy circuit, the way they create it. So when I was around, in the early 80s when it all kind of started kicking off here, mid-80s really, we started kicking off in London, and there was nobody who'd gone ahead of us. There was nobody to kind of teach anybody anything about comedy. Everybody just worked it out through experience. I mean, the stakes weren't very high, so don't forget, it's not like Finland, it's very unlikely that'll be televised and stuff yet. I mean, I don't know, but...
They are televising it.
Already?
Yeah.
So that's unfortunate, because what happened in London was it wasn't televised for a long time, and it took absolutely forever before they even managed. I mean, there was no Paramount Comedy Channel, there was no, well, there wasn't cable TV channels, but, you know, what was great about the London circuit first starting out was there just wasn't really anybody other than the people coming to clubs. And it was a different circuit in the beginning from how it developed. So someone like Finland, they are going to develop their own way of being comics. They're going to advise each other and work stuff out according to what the audience does. So it's almost like the whole country will work out
what comedy
is for them.
Yes.
It might be different. I mean, I think the American circuit's a little bit different from the English circuit. I mean, each circuit's going to be different.
Yeah.
Different subjects the audience will or won't like. Different styles of comedy. How exciting. I mean, they should create their own brand of comedy, their own circuit as such.
Well, that's another question that comes to. It's a lot of people say comedy is comedy. If the audience laughs, it's funny. And I would not agree. I think there are certain audiences for certain comics. I think there are certain situations for certain types of comedy. I think there are certain places where you can do one style of comedy, certain places where you can't. I mean, some of the very hardcore, heavy-hitting, attitudinal, you know, let's say aggressive comics,
they
might not really be able to do a family-based show in Edinburgh.
Of course.
Absolutely. Which is so natural, so I don't think something that's funny is necessarily always funny.
I think it's a difficult question. I mean, undoubtedly somebody is laughing. Yeah, no thanks. Throw it to me. Well, my thoughts on this, because obviously new acts do say that too, say, oh, well, the audience laughed. There are a couple of things on this. I think the thing is that one of the difficult things with new acts is they say, oh, the audience laughed. So what I did was funny, yes, but did they like the fact that they laughed? I think that's a very interesting thing that happens with audiences sometimes, is that somebody does material that makes them laugh, but they really rather they hadn't laughed at it.
Mm.
And the gig starts to take on a slightly uncomfortable feel, because they know they're laughing at stuff that really is making them feel a little bit uncomfortable, and they're not liking the experience. I think that's something you have to watch out for. I mean, if somebody laughs at something, then undoubtedly it is funny. I think it's just for the comic to decide what they want to be encouraging people to laugh at.
Yeah. Yeah.
Essentially, there's got to be some sense of what's okay to be encouraging an audience to laugh at. I mean, I know people at the moment are swinging back against the guidelines behind comedy. I personally still agree with them, but I think
just for those who don't know.
Well, there are certain guidelines that when comedy very first started in the old days, people were very clear about, like it was going to be an alternative. The reason why it's called alternative comedy, I mean, God, that title has so long since been forgotten. But there was a very little short period of time where this kind of comedy we're talking about was called alternative. And it's because it was an alternative to what was the mainstream of the day. So the mainstream of the day in the 70s was racist, sexist, mother-in-law jokes, basically. I mean, there's some other things, but those are the basic ones that most people know. So originally there's a route to this comedy, and the route was to be an alternative to that, to find different things to laugh at. So that's what this style of comedy has grown out of. And I think you have to respect the root of a particular genre of comedy if you're wanting to be involved in it. Now, what's been happening lately, I think, is extremely interesting, is that very established comics, and for instance, Aussie Little Britain, which is not actually stand-up comedy, but which is a comedy show, people are playing with those guidelines. But I think what's happening is that new acts are not quite understanding that the reason why established comics can now play with those guidelines is because they know the audience knows them. The audience innately knows what those guidelines are now because they've watched so much comedy. So if a comic plays with them, the audience laughs. There's a connection. Again, like we're all hot in this room, the room's a bit empty. Somebody, a comic saying something, just it, bordering towards a setup that looks like it's going to be a racist joke, the audience are going to be tense as hell. And then you do a right turn in your punchline, it's not a racist joke, it's all okay, everybody can relax and laugh. It's now people are being cleverer with those guidelines and going, okay, well, what do the audience, okay, well, if I do this, if I do that, the audience might think this, or kind of borderline. Little Britain isn't going against the guidelines because it's playing with them in actually a very clever way. So people tend to be black and white about them. But there's something more interesting happening. The people who don't understand them often are new acts. You just think, oh, the guidelines have gone. It'd be really exciting if I'm really sexist and racist and I talk about crippled people and that's funny. And they're sort of missing the point a bit, that the guidelines are still there and the point is the audience knows them. I was at the comedy store recently, the comedy store, big comedy club in central London. The first, in fact, comedy club in central London. And I noticed that the audience is even really actually very sensitive about certain things. I mean, it's got much stronger. The audience has their own morality. Mm. And they have absorbed those guidelines, and they're really not crazy about it if you cross them. But they love it if you make them think you're going to, and then don't do it.
And they become part of the game again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's what happens with comedy. It develops. Those guidelines are always there as a route, and things continue to develop.
I mean, the famous case of Billy Connolly making the joke the day before, Begley was executed. They didn't know he was under suspicion he was going to get executed in Iraq, I think it was. And Billy Connolly did the big joke in the Albert Hall, and it was all over the press, and he kept on defending it and saying, but it was funny. I have the right, I have the right. And the audience made it very clear that he didn't.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really, really interesting, cover going into this territory. It's like, yeah, if the audience either is laughing out of complete embarrassment and discomfort, or they're not laughing, it ain't funny.
And they're much more likely to just not laugh at the moment. There'll be blank silence. I tell you, I think that my thought on this is actually something that, in terms of the guidelines, I do teach students. I start off by talking about those original guidelines and then making sure the students understand where those guidelines are today, so that they really do understand the root of what they're getting involved in. I think it's important to understand the history of this genre of comedy if you want to be involved in it. But a great thing that actually Mark Thomas once said to me about those guidelines was, you can talk about anything you like if you're clever enough.
Yeah.
And I think Mark Thomas is that person who does talk about anything he likes, but he's clever enough to. And it's that if you're clever enough, that is a problem when you're a new act.
A lot of them do think they're clever enough.
Yeah, and that's what characterises new acts above all things, is that they just trample all over the guidelines, talk about anything, and the audience gets shocked and it's not funny. I think if you start off abiding by them a bit, then you're going to be fine. And once you're more established and know what you're doing, then start playing with them. Why worry about banging your head against them now? What's the point? Just concentrate on being a good comic.
Yeah.
It's funny how people kind of bang their head against certain things with the new acts, and I just think, well, why bother? It's hard enough being a comic without trying to bang your head against that. And you've got enough on your plate to learn right now. You want to be hugely controversial, brilliant, but just wait until you become a comic first.
So what would you say, once you've established these guidelines, they've got their 5 minutes of material, they're out there running, what is the next thrust of your workshop, really, in the advanced workshop? What's the ethos behind it that you're trying to set up?
really the advanced workshop is to support them to gig and support them to actually become established comics, not support them to stay on the New Act circuit. And I think that the next big thrust for everyone in their careers is getting off the New Act circuit and onto the established circuit, and that has become now a very, very difficult thing to do, to transfer. So it's sort of like an agent's expression, I suppose, but to transfer. So what tends to happen is that people gradually start to do okay on what the New Act circuit, which is New Act nights, the smaller clubs that use the smaller comics that are less established. And then what they've got to do is try and break through that and actually get onto what's now become basically the main circuit, which is the bigger clubs that use the established comics, and they need to then have an act that will transfer. Now, I think most new acts don't. I think this is one of the things that bothers me most about what's happened in the last few years, really, I suppose, over the last 10 years. It used to be, in the old days of the circuit, that all the comedy clubs were just comedy clubs, and there would be a new act on, a slightly newish act, then there'd be somebody be going a bit longer, and a headliner, and the bill would be all different levels of comics in every single club, which meant that you learnt your trade from the people who knew more than you, who were ahead of you. You were working with them, you were doing gigs with them, and so it meant that there was no difference really between new acts and established acts if the new acts were really, you know, actually determined to become comics. But what's happened gradually over the years is that that's begun to split. I mean, new act nights didn't exist when I was a comic, they didn't have them. But then new acts always got open spots at the big clubs. So gradually what's happened over the years is that we now have a new act circuit, which is all small clubs, new act nights, some of them absolutely atrocious, some of them grey, full of people who are new acts. Now, they can easily become trapped there because they learn to play to the audiences in those clubs. And the big, big difference between a new act and an established comic, there is a very big difference between the sound of the two. One of the main differences is the grossness. New acts tend to be very gross. Established comics,
as in talking about sexual stuff,
in a really gross, heavy way. Charm free, a bit repellent, kind of really going over the top with kind of make people go, ugh. But what I've noticed is that you watch that act do it. If you watch a comic do their act in a new act club, it'll go fine. Audience will laugh. It's fine. They're not really expecting that much more than that. You put that same act in the comedy store, the audience may just not laugh at all. Or they will actually go, oh, I've watched that happen, watched an act do that. And the same jokes we're getting an oh from the audience and stuff. It's because the main circuit has an entirely different style of comedy now. Now that's a problem. Because what's happening with the new act circuit is it's no longer training comics to become part of the main circuit. And that divide has got to somehow be bridged. Because we're not actually doing a service to our new comics by having let that happen. There's no bridge between the two. So I quite often get comics coming to me who've been going for a couple of years. They just can't transfer onto the main circuit. They can't get a decent open spot at the Banana, or they want to try out the store, or they want to get into Jongleurs or whatever. I mean, all these things are like quite a way off, but they want to know what's going wrong, why they're not able to transfer. And whenever I look at their act, it's always a certain number of things, and you can actually tell the difference between a new act type of material and established comics type of material. And to get someone who's a new act to turn into an established act takes a number of things, but it can be done provided they're a good act. You have to say, okay, what you need to do is the structure needs to be better, you need to edit this, you need to cut that, it's too gross, you need to make that cleverer. And it can be done. But you can hear it. It's a sound. It's just almost like a sound and a way of performing. So that divide concerns me. Because the ultimate aim, I suppose, I always say, that is on my course, the ultimate focus is to teach people to end up on the established main circuit. They might have a rougher time on the new act circuit, but that's not where they're going. That's a practice ground. That isn't the end in itself. The end in itself should be the main circuit. Having said that, it is their choice what they want to do. But I think there's a serious problem with this gap. I'm actually going to be, so you're actually the first person I've told, I'm actually going to be running a comedy club at the Comedia, which Comedia Theatre in Brighton, where I'm teaching my workshops at the moment. And what I'm doing is I'm going to create a new act club that is run the way they should be, in my opinion, only in my opinion, but a club that will actually teach people to do the kind of material that will get them across onto the, that will actually bridge this gap. So there'll be people doing fives, a couple of people doing fives, a couple of people doing tens, a headliner, and an established compere. And the sensibility of that club will have the same sensibility as an established club.
Mm.
It's the Creator Club runs at the Commedia, a very successful club. Now, this night that I'm going to be running, which is called Comic Boom, will be starting in January. It'll be a monthly club. It's the last Wednesday of every month. This will be a new act with the sensibility of an established club. So there's always a headliner on for you to learn from. There's people doing fives who are just starting, there are people doing tens who are a bit further ahead of you. There's a decent compere. It'll be in a great venue. I mean, it's the same venue as the Crater. So it's a really nice venue with a big audience. And
what's it hold, about 250, 300 or something?
Yeah, they just expanded it to 300.
Right.
So the new act nights I've been running there are at the end of the course. At the end of the course, there's always a new act night for everyone who's just done the course. Those have been selling out and going really, really well. So the Commedia have said, will you actually run a monthly club? But my aim with this club is to try and bridge that gap.
Yeah.
I want to provide a club that actually gives new acts the chance to actually really train to become...
Because a lot of clubs do... They might give an open spot, but if they're giving an open spot to someone who already has an established 20...
That's
not
exactly
quite
it.
The same thing.
Yeah, not the same thing at all. Yeah, and how do they get to that point? It is very difficult. I think the hardest thing for any comic to do is transfer from the new act circuit to the main circuit. It's really difficult, and it's become incredibly difficult. But there are no clubs that... I mean, maybe there are one or two, but there aren't really any specific clubs trying to bridge that gap. And basically, I suppose that's just what that's what my intention is with this club. Because obviously I'm teaching there at that venue, and the Commedia are incredibly supportive, very keen on supporting local talent. I've been able to actually sort of talk to them about creating the kind of club that I think we need. I suppose it's filling a gap.
And what would you say is the main difference between a 5-minute set, whatever level you are, and a 20-minute set?
It's massive. I mean, it's massive, the difference between a 5 and a 20. Apart from anything else, it's trying to get new acts to maintain their energy over that amount of time is very difficult. I personally think you should build in increments. I think you should do a 5. Well, I actually start people off on 3. In the beginner's course, they just do 3. Because that's enough. You know, that's enough to start with, to learn everything you need to learn and then practice it and get a good 3 together. And those shows that they do at the end of that beginner's course of Commedia have been amazing. They've been fab. I'm so impressed with the students. They've done absolutely brilliantly. And each of their... It's a tight 3-minute set. And they've all done very well. Because that's what they can manage to do feasibly.
And it stops them from padding, which is what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've got 3 minutes. There's no time to spend a minute.
No, absolutely.
Say hello to the audience.
No, they haven't got time for that, no. And then the next thing I moved them on to is a 5. At the end of the next term, which is the advanced workshop, which I don't actually run at the Commedia, but the advanced workshop, they're aiming them for a 5. So they're adding 2 minutes to their 3, maybe rewriting bits of that 3, learning from what they learned from doing the new act night at the Commedia. So they move on to 5. The next thing inevitably they move on to is 7 or 8 for competitions. Most of the competitions are from 7 or 8. So generally I think that works best. You just move forward a couple of minutes at a time. By the time you've got a 10, which I think it takes a long time to get a really good 10, once you've got a good 10, I think going from a good 10 to a 20 is not such a big leap.
Right, it's the 5 to the 10 that's the hard bit.
I think 5 to 10 is the hardest. Mm. That will take the longest. 10 to 20 by then.
And you think it's an energy thing, the 20 minutes?
Well, it's also, I mean, it's the being good enough to write good enough material to last 20 minutes, quite frankly, that isn't padded out. So, I mean, a new act can sit down and write a 20 minutes there, but quite often it's just full of padding and it's just not strong enough and it's not a good enough 20. Well, it's not the kind of 20 that's going to get them paid bookings and going to get them onto the main circuit. I think, but if you write, if your first 10 is written a bit at a time, no padding, you learn what you need to learn, you know, you've really got that working, then your 20 is going to be the same. But I mean, a 20 that's not well structured, that's not well written, that's got lots of padding in it, I can't see the point. You'd be better off with a good 10.
Mm.
I mean, a lot of bookers will say, I would say to students, you must be very, very clear about whether you've got a 5 or a 10. So if a booker says, oh, can you do 10, and you don't have a 10, don't say yes, because you don't have a 10.
Mm.
And a lot of bookers say, well, I would rather you said to me, I've got a tight 5, than agreed to do a 10, and it was a woolly 10. So most of my students will say, well, I've got a tight 5, or I've got a tight 7, and the booker will always just go, great, do that then. They don't want some woolly 10 when they'd rather just have a brilliant 5.
And what would you say the difference is from doing like the comedy circuit in the clubs, doing a 20-minute, to doing your own show of comedy, stand-up comedy at Edinburgh of an hour, or hopefully you will then from there go on out into doing venues all over the world or all over Britain doing an hour? What would you say is the...
Well, I think the thing about the hour-long shows, I suppose I personally feel that a lot of people rush. And it's just my personal opinion and the way I work, I guess. It does seem to me that people rush a lot and don't necessarily gain anything by rushing. Because to learn the craft to really make sure that what you're doing is working, I think is more important. But an hour show, I think that's a massive leap from 20. But when you're doing 20s, when you're getting paid to do 20-minute gigs, how lovely to then go, right, I'm going to do an hour. I think personally the key to doing an hour-long show is that you need to have a real theme, a real reason, as something you want to tackle. So I mean, we mentioned earlier, didn't we, Andre Vincent's show about cancer. I just know that what I don't think works in an hour show is doing an hour set randomly, because that's fine, but I think, God, it takes, you have to be huge to pull that off. I think you have to be Jack D. You know, you have to be one of the top people. I saw a wonderful Phil Kay doing that. It was fabulous. Ross Noble, there are some... who was it I saw? Can't remember the name. Dylan Moran, I saw recently, doing a great hour-long show. These people are going for a very long time, and just to do a set that goes over an hour, great. That's going to work for them. But that's a long way off. That's a very long way off, I think, for most people. I think you've got to be playing all the top clubs, doing 20s, and actually looking for another challenge. That someone newer doing an hour-long show, I think the key has got to be, it's got to be about something. It's not just your material kind of stretched to an hour with a couple of your mates doing some sketches. That's not really an hour show. An hour show, I think, earlier on stage, it's like there needs to be something that it's focused on.
Mm.
And you're going to need to write an hour show, not cobble together bits of your set.
For me, the successful shows can also include, which I... This is only me speaking, but you can't really put into a comedy set of 20 minutes or 10 minutes as you can put stories in.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think what's exciting about an hour show is you've got a lot more room. You can also talk about subjects that maybe you wouldn't talk about in a club.
Mm.
And that's another interesting thing. Occasionally new comics in the class will say, I really want to tackle this. And I'll go, okay, that is fascinating. But that really is the subject of a one-hour show, and that'll be great. So why don't you save that? Put that aside for your Edinburgh show. Because quite often topics come up that you just think, that's not going to work in a club. But given time and a lot of time to explain what you're talking about, great. Yeah, I think an hour show is a very exciting challenge, but I think it's one you take when you've learnt the first bit.
Mm.
Learn the first bit first, know what you're doing there, and then look at it as the next stage.
Mm. Well, again, Frank Skinner was a classic example of someone who claims to... Well, I believe him, it's not a claim, that he did 25 minutes of new material every single week when he started off, and I think within 9 months was doing his show in Edinburgh. Well, it is amazing.
Fantastic if you can do it.
And I think a lot... I never saw his first show in Edinburgh, obviously, but I would guess that he could then allow for funny stories... as well as set up punch, a straight joke as well, and you can combine those two, which is very hard to do in 20 minutes, to allow 5 minutes to tell a story.
Yeah, I don't think you can do it on the circuit, but I think you certainly do it in an hour-long show, definitely, because they'll come to see you as well. Here's that wonderful comic, Stuart Lee, who does that wonderful stuff that never really worked amazingly well on the circuit, because it's too story-like and it's too long, but absolute genius. Now, you watch an hour show of his, wonderful. Absolutely wonderful, but not so good in the clubs. The thing is, the clubs are quite limiting, and I think it's when you find the clubs limiting that it's time to
Move on to something else.
They are quite limiting.
Yeah,
because you're performing to a load of drunk people who want to laugh a lot quickly, and they don't want to. You know, that's the arena, the work arena you're in.
Well, actually, let's stop there.